Guys,
Hi.
you can see us. How crazy is this?
Oh boy, this is gonna be fun.
Some of you are probably still listening on podcast. Please keep doing that. But we're also officially on YouTube,
On YouTube,
where
you
you
can
can see
see
us.
us.
You can see mom looking like Madonna. She got on and I said, "What is that?"
My very old headset, but hey, it works.
Yeah, it's a microphone. I said you
And
needed headphones and a microphone.
you look totally official.
Official, yes.
All I have is Aiden's headphones, so this
They have
looks a
like
little
sticker ball
better.
sticker, sticker ball sticker, soccer ball stickers, and like stickers on the side of your headphones. Yeah.
Cool.
Okay, so this is episode 132 of Killer Hangover.
Holy
I
guacamole.
am Beth.
And I am Bettina.
Those watching us on YouTube, we've never done this. We've been doing it for our Patreon for a little while now, but kind of venturing into the unknown. So
Please be patient. There will be bloopers.
are not perfect at all. I'm like nervous. I'm like playing with my paper like a kid in school. I have the true crime. Mom has the paranormal and the cocktail. What are you drinking?
I made the devil and disguised. So not the devil in disguise.
Okay,
It's
I was
the
just going to
devil
ask.
and disguise. And it comes from recipe.timesofinda.com.
Okay.
It'll be posted in our links on
Okay.
our website.
Sounds good. So, what kind
So,
of cocktail is this?
well, this is, it says milligrams, but it's like 2 ounces. Okay. So 60
Okay.
milligrams of vodka, a dash of lime juice. I used a real lime, 8 basil leaves.
Oh,
So
you
I went
love
out
basil.
and bought a plant yesterday, a basil plant, so I could
Oh.
use the basil leaves. 1.5 cups of pomegranate seeds. I got the ones that are already seeded. And 30 milligrams, so just a splash of sugar syrup.
What is sugar syrup?
You can make it. It's like a, it's sugar and water, and you stir it, and it kind of makes a syrupy thing. But I used agave.
I was just gonna say, you could do,
I used agave. So, step one, mix all the ingredients in a cocktail shaker with ice cubes. Mix, 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 shake, shake, shake. Okay. Then you pour it, strain it into one of these glasses.
martini glass
Yeah.
for those
And
not watching.
then, oh, yeah, a martini glass. Sorry. And then it says, this is why I like this cocktail. Garnish the cocktail the way you like and serve immediately. Well,
Garnish
the
the way
way we
you
like
like.
it is no garnish. Garnish. So here you
Perfect.
go. So cheers.
That's perfect. Cheers.
Whoops, I gotta move my.
Madonna forgot to move her headphone.
Oh, it's okay. How can I say this correctly? You have to like basil
Basil
because
and pomegranate. Does that go good together? Does that go well
basil
together?
is really prominent. It's delicious. It's herbally, it's not sweet. For those of you who like sweet drinks, this may not be up your alley, but boy, you can taste the basil. It's delicious. It is really, really good. And
Okay.
look, it's healthy too. You can have several of these. I'm just saying.
Okay. Well, sorry, I'm not joining you. I'm enjoying my coffee.
Okay.
We still have about what, 2 months before I pop this baby out. So,
Yeah.
looking forward to sharing those cocktails with you all then.
Me too.
So,
I'm
on a rating
tired of
scale,
drinking alone.
what would you rate this cocktail? Like, we've had so many on this show, and somebody
I
asked
know.
us we should start some kind of a rating. Is it? I don't even know how you would do the rating because there's so many different ones.
Are we doing a 5-star rating kind of thing?
Sure.
Okay. I would rate this 3.5.
Okay.
I mean, it is really good, but again, you need pomegranates and you
You kind
need
of threw me with the herbally taste. I don't know if I'm a fan of the herbally taste.
but you got the sweet too with the
Yeah.
pomegranate, the splash of lime juice just kind of brings it all together.
Yeah, that, any cocktail that has that lime juice, we've talked about this so many times. Is it
It just cuts, ties it together.
Yeah, it does. And it cuts on any bitterness of alcohol or anything like that.
I don't taste the vodka at all.
See, then I would rate it higher because those kind of drinks I like because you feel
Well,
like.
it would definitely, I mean, it tastes like a four, but you do have to have a lot of ingredients. I mean, you know, like
you don't have
things
those
you
things
don't have
on
hand.
Gotcha.
So that's why I'm putting it at 3.5.
Gotcha. Okay. Well, if you hear pitter patter of little feet like I am hearing right now, we did have a snow day today. So.
Yeah, but I don't hear them.
Okay. Well, good. Let's just hope the pitter patter stays a pitter patter and not jumping and something else. They're supposed to be eating lunch and then watching their movie. They're 5 and 7. We will see.
Oh, sweet boys.
They played outside in the snow, though, for like 2.5, almost 3 hours until a snowball fight started. And the snow went into Nolan's hoodie.
Oh, no.
And so he came up and he's like, I'm just so cold. And I'm like, you are soaking wet. So we stripped him down. We put PJs on. We put the fireplace on. And they played with toys the rest of the morning. They were out there like 9 a.m. So
nice. Kick them out.
Yeah.
It was fresh air. Never hurt anyone.
Great. Okay. True
All
crime.
Right. I'm ready.
I'm beyond excited to share the story with you guys. Beyond excited. Do you have any hint of what I'm doing?
No.
I know you kind of, like, we have an attached Google Docs. So did you see my notes or anything? I'm just so always curious.
No,
you
I because I accident. No, I never do. I might accidentally open it because I'm trying to open different things.
I don't care. I don't care if you look.
But I never read it. Because that's just not fun for me then when you're reading it for having already read it.
That's true.
New presentation.
I'm excited. Okay. Today's true crime story is a story in a story. Okay. I really didn't know how I wanted to start this because I thought going into this, the story was going to be very straightforward. It's one that you've heard. It's one I've heard. It's one our listeners have heard. Thought it was going to be very straightforward. I was so wrong. I was so wrong. I'm covering someone I've known. Like I said, you've known.
We know them, huh?
Well, not personally. This was like a long time ago. We don't know them. They've been dead for a very long time. Diving into this research, I learned that this guy has just been sensationalized so much. It's been dramatized. I mean, in movies, and I don't mean just in Hollywood movies. I mean, like, even back when it happened in 1893.
Oh.
Let's just put it this way. The chief of police that was put in charge of this investigation, he was a flower and feed dealer just a few months before this investigation. He had no law enforcement experience. That was hard to say. I don't know why. He had no investigative experience. He was hired purely for political reasons. Just, yeah. And while he was leading this investigation, he invited the media to come along with him.
We kind of like, why not?
And this was during the yellow journalism era. Do you know what that is?
Yeah, we spoke about it when we talked about the Black Dahlia.
That's exactly right. So the yellow journalism era, for those that don't know, is essentially a style of newspaper reporting that emphasizes sensationalism over facts. They're just trying to sell the paper. So like the findings in this case, and I'm using bunny ears for those listening, say they found a bench down when they were doing the investigation. The papers might write, we found an embalming table, when it was really just a bench. But they're trying to put that dramatic spin on things to sell papers. And that has become this story. It has stayed with this story. That sensationalism has stayed with this story. It's a good story. I mean, I'm going to share with you the sensationalized version and the real version. I'm going to share with you all the urban legend. I think that's a good way to put it. And the facts discovered by historians about H.H. Holmes.
Oh, okay.
America's first serial killer.
Serial killer. Ugh, he was creepy. Okay. Maybe not.
But
maybe
was he?
the only creepiness I know is sensationalized.
Now, I'm not saying he didn't do bad things or that he wasn't a serial killer. I mean, again, he was named America's first serial killer. He himself joined in on the sensationalizing of his story, and he ended up claiming that he killed 27 people. And then he even said, quote, "I was born with the devil in me. I could not help the fact that I was a murderer. More than a poet can help the inspiration to sing," unquote.
Does a poet sing?
I was just about to say that.
Okay.
But of those 27 people he claimed to have killed, over half of them were still alive when he told the media this.
Oh my gosh.
Can you imagine you just like walking the street like, "You're alive? H.H. Holmes said he killed you." Anyway, if we go with the facts and the proof, he likely killed 9 people, which is still a lot of people. Don't get me wrong.
Yeah, he's still a serial killer.
Yeah. And this really reminds me of that Henry Lee Lucas and like his tales of his
hundreds
numbers.
Of people. Yes.
Yeah, sure. But still, like I said, killing 9 people is a lot of people. Sorry, my nose is really itchy. I'm like self-conscious now to rub my nose with this being on YouTube. That girl that constantly rubs her nose. My mom and I did find, though, in my defense, that this thing I put on my microphone, I think I'm allergic to it. So
yeah, she always gets kind of snotty when she's around it. So.
Sorry. Okay, let's just get into this. He was born in New Hampshire, May 16th. This is 861. I believe it was 1861. And his real name, did you know, was Herman Webster Mudgett.
Mudgett. No wonder he changed it.
Yes. Now, he's so different than any other serial killers. It's really fascinating to me because there's no abuse. He was never seen abusing or mistreating animals. There was no fall or hit to the head. His parents, Levi Horton Mudgett and Theodate Page Price, supported their 3 kids. He had an older sister and an older brother. And Levi, his brother, worked hard, did odd jobs where he could on farms as a painter, a trader. I take that back. Levi's brother, I'm sure he did that too, but so did Herman. Herman did that as well. Herman had odd jobs. He'd paint. I mean, he was a hard worker. He actually even called himself a mother's boy. He was a self-proclaimed mama's boy. He had friends and was active in the community and their Methodist church. He graduated high school at 16. And now this is kind of funny, but he married his high school girlfriend. Mm-hmm. And you're going to see this theme of him and women throughout this whole story. Clara Lovering was her name, like right out of high school. The two get married at 17 secretly. They go to the courthouse and they get married.
Ooh.
But they each live still at their own, at their parents' houses for like a year.
Oh.
And then their parents find out, well, by the time the parents find out, she's pregnant. And so they help the couple move into their own place. They got Herman a job at like her parents. I don't know if they owned the grocery store or they knew who owned the grocery store, but he started working at a grocery store. But he wanted to go to college. He had a passion and he wanted to work in the medical field. Now, let me remind you, this guy joined in on this sensationalizing of his story. I mean, he heard people talking and he liked what they were saying. So that being said, he wrote about his life and he shared a story about how he became obsessed with the medical field, the human body and dissection, to be more specific.
Mm-hmm.
He shared a story that when he was a boy, there was a local doctor in the area who, rumor had it, he kept like body parts around in his office. Now,
okay,
like autopsies and stuff back then were not, it was newer or not a thing yet. Like it wasn't, cutting up people's bodies was like, people didn't do that. So I think it was just like the start of doing that. This doctor was said to have been doing that and had like body parts in his doctor's office.
Probably in formaldehyde.
Herman was terrified of going to the doctor and like would terrified of the stories and everything. He was like 13, I think, when this happened. So the older boys in the neighborhood decided to tackle him and pull him into the doctor's office. And they took him in front of a skeleton that the doctor had there. and they made the skeleton's hand touch his face. They like held him down and they're like tormenting him with this skeleton. Herman says his fear fell away and curiosity of the human body took over. I would be traumatized.
I'm not even afraid of skeletons. Like but... screaming, and then, oh.
And then like as it's touching his face, like, oh, this is interesting. Weird. He went on to write about how others were very jealous of him as he continued schooling at the University of Michigan's Department of Medicine and Surgery, how he was very ambitious and smart. Historians have come to find a difference in this little story. One historian in particular, I really enjoyed reading articles on. He has an awesome website. I will link it. He was also on the History Channel's podcast. His name is Adam Salser. He said that Herman actually barely passed med school and that the professors actually passed him out of pity.
Nobody used to ever pity me in college. I needed some pitying.
Now, while he was attending med school, he was still married to Clara and their son. They had a son. They moved in with him in the boarding house at medical school. They're near campus and the two fought all the time. And in 1884, Clara took the baby and moved back in with her family in New Hampshire. And although technically still married, he pretty much lived a free man in college. Just, you know, he dated a lot. He proposed to a lot of girls or like promised, I will marry you. He was something else. There are also stories that while in med school, he and friends would steal corpses and even dig up fresh corpses from local cemeteries and do one of two things, either dissect them and sell the skeletons to med schools, or they would stage deaths and claim life insurance money on these bodies. I'm not sure, and there weren't not facts on this. It is something that he will do later on in life.
Right. Yeah. Yeah.
But there's also some legend that in the boarding house, once his wife moved out, the roommates in the area or like the people who live next to him started smelling something from his room. And when the landlord, landscaper probably does not care.
The landscaper at the cemetery noticed a bunch of holes.
When they went to go find out what the smell was, they found dead babies under his bed. And he was like learning how to dissect and using these babies. And they were like, yeah, no more of that, please. And he's like, okay, sure. But again, there's no like proof in that. Like,
right.
I feel like they would kick him out if they're like,
no more of that.
Disc, okay. Yeah. But and again, I just wanted to show you the sensationalized stories that have been told everywhere and
questions.
Yeah.
About the stories. Okay.
Yeah. What I'm sure of, though, is that Herman had three passions in his life. Dissecting corpses. He really did enjoy that. The second love was courting women. You will see a theme, like I said. After graduating, he moved to New York and worked as a school teacher and in a physician's office for a while, all the while courting woman after woman after woman, proposing. Like I said, I think historians know he proposed to at least two of them in New York. I mean,
did they all say no or what?
I think he just like gets sick of them and then just leaves.
Oh. We're just okay. Never mind.
You can see the text. I sent you text before we started. You can look at these pictures of him. He was said to be incredibly handsome. Women just fawned over him. And I mean,
that's an 1800s thing. But...
yeah, I don't know. And we'll post these pictures for, again, those listening. We'll post it. And I'm going to try to even get a picture in right here.
He looks like a gopher, like a gopher animal.
So he's like, the mustache is like a thing. The mustache was a thing back then, and he had a good one. I guess he was just very
droopy,
but he was very confident. He acted rich and acted very prestigious, although he wasn't. And so I think that I don't know. I wasn't around back then to really fully assess his romantic side.
Well, who knows? Maybe he had charm and, you know.
Oh, he had
charisma
charm.
And stuff.
You will definitely see a lot of charm. He could charm men, women, anything. Like, he was a charmer.
Obviously, the landlord, too.
That story's true, yeah. Okay, the third love he had was scamming people. He worked selling books door to door at a time. Now, Herman was, like I said, a charmer. Very handsome, everybody said. And he's very persistent. He dressed the part of a successful businessman. So he's selling these books door to door. And if the people wanted these books, he conned them into paying him then. And then he'd say, okay, I'll have your books shipped or Pony Express to you, you know, in the next couple of weeks. Have a good day. Well, he's not really selling books. He's obviously taking this money and running. And do you remember back when I lived in Charlotte and we had that guy come to our door and he was selling magazine subscriptions? And I like was very charming guy. And I was like this close. And Alex is like, what are you doing? I need the checkbook, honey. He's like, no, you don't. What are you doing? So I almost got caught in a scam like this.
Well, you don't know. Maybe the guy really had magazines.
No, I'm pretty sure he didn't.
Oh, okay. No.
In 1886, now going by his name H.H. Holmes, because who could take a guy named Mudgett seriously? And that's a total joke. If your name is Mudgett, I'm so sorry. I'm not.
Really, Beth? Oh, my goodness.
Bad joke. Bad joke. Sorry. But he wanted to change his name. And back then, I guess you could do that really easily. You could just change your name.
Change your name.
Very easily. So with the huge growth rate of the city, he decides to move to Chicago. Chicago at this time is crazy. They had that really big fire in like 1871, and it burnt down a lot of the city. And so they've rebuilt everything. And so they have like these beautiful new buildings and skyscrapers and infrastructure, and they have all this land now. So they're just growing, growing, growing. That being said, it's the industrial boom, like I said before, but the growth in the population and these buildings, the police force is not growing, keeping up with this growth.
Oh, okay.
So there is a lot of crime and it's dirty and it's exciting to live in Chicago. They're trying to make a name for themselves. They're trying to be the new New York, but their police presence and keeping it clean, it was really hard for them to do because it was growing so quickly. Okay, so he sets his sights. He has his Chicago as H.H. Holmes, and he sets his sights on a pharmacy in Inglewood. It's on the outskirts of
I've been
Chicago.
There.
He traveled to Springfield to obtain his pharmacy license. So he goes, he sees his pharmacy, he's like, I want it. He goes and he gets his pharmacy license. He passes his exams, and he did a little traveling before he goes to buy his new pharmacy. So before he heads back to Chicago, he's traveling, and in Minneapolis. I always want to add an extra N, and I don't know why. Minneapolis. He meets and falls in love and marries Myrta Belknap. Keep in mind, he's still also married to Claire Lovering.
Right.
So now this is his second wife. They travel back to Chicago. He heads to that pharmacy he had his eye on. Now, why was his eye on this pharmacy? Well, a few reasons. First, the pharmacist, Dr. Holton, wasn't doing so well health-wise and was very sick with cancer, and his wife was scrambling to keep their pharmacy afloat. And there was an empty lot of land just across the street from the pharmacy. And with the help of the family money he had just married into, he could potentially buy it and go on to build his number one scam, his hotel or his building, whatever you want to call it. The castle is what he named it. We'll come back to that. First he had to work on this pharmacy scam. I mean, plan. H.H. Holmes slides in, offering his help. Remember, he's a charmer. He steps up to the poor, distraught wife, eventually convincing her to put the pharmacy in his name, and he would to make payments to her.
Oh.
The husband soon dies, and those payments that the woman was promised by Holmes, well, they aren't ever being paid, and she threatens a lawsuit. Well, wouldn't you know it? Before long, the wife, Elizabeth Holton, disappears. Holmes tells locals that she had left Chicago to stay with family in California. There was nothing left for her in Chicago now that her husband had died and the pharmacy was just failing. The pharmacy was now officially H.H. Holmes.
Yes.
Record scratch. Rewind. Can't do that. I don't know what to do with the sound there. The story I just shared is part of the urban legend. Historians, like I mentioned before, Adam Seltzer, for example, have discovered the facts of this story. And you know what's sad is that that story is told when telling H.H. Holmes' history by so many people. And here are the facts. Yes, Holmes married Myrta. And yes, it was most likely for her family's money. And yes, when Holmes moved to Chicago, he did set his sights on a pharmacy in Inglewood on the edge of the Chicago city. And yes, according to archives, the pharmacy was run by a Dr. Holton, a Dr. Elizabeth Sarah Holton.
Oh.
The husband was alive and well, no cancer. He had a traveling job. Dr. Holton was about to have her second child and wanted to sell the pharmacy. Holmes purchased the pharmacy on the up and up. Totally fair. He bought the pharmacy from her. Dr. Holton, her husband, and their children remained in the neighborhood until the 20th century.
Well, that's boring.
I know. I know. I'm sorry. So the pharmacy was purchased fairly, but the swindling was soon to follow. Holmes purchased barbershop equipment to fill his new pharmacy. And I guess that was like the thing to have a barbershop in your pharmacy back then.
Okay.
So he puts all of this on credit. The man loved to use credit. And he never had any intention on paying any of his bills. Now, what about that empty lot across the street? Well, he had a plan for this too. It was actually three lots, lot 701 through 703. And he used his new wife, because he was still married to Carla again, but he's using his new wife. He uses her family money and her inheritance that he got when he married her. They buy mm-hmm. this land, but he keeps the land in his wife's name. And then he actually then later, like a year later, will put the land in his mother-in-law's name to try to keep the creditors away. I mean, he was...
Oh.
Yeah. Was it Shiesty McShiesterson? Is that what people say? Probably not. Okay, now this is where I don't know how to continue the story. Do I share the urban legend or do I share the facts? Because like you said, the facts are kind of boring and the urban legend's really fun. I really don't know. I didn't know how to proceed from here. So I'm going to try to keep both. But you've heard the stories of the murder castle, correct?
Yes.
I think most people have. Secret passageways, hidden rooms, doorways that lead nowhere, narrow hallways
that end nowhere.
And then these greased chutes that go to the cellar where there was embalming yes. tables and all the hotel rooms, because this is a hotel. The hotel rooms were soundproof, and some of them even had gas that would go into the vents by just a push of a button from his office.
Amazing, amazing.
I know. And the furnace in the basement was just large enough to fit a body. I cannot tell you how much of this is true. I don't think any of it is true. I can tell you, though, that the castle was essentially built for free. So legend says that he would hire a crew and make this hallway here, and then mm-hmm. he'd fire them because he didn't want anybody to know the layout of his castle. He didn't even have architects. This is what the legend says. Architects work on it. He drew it out himself. He would hire different crews to do different things and then fire them so that nobody knew what the layout, what was inside the walls. Like there was like hallways between the rooms so that he could go, and there's like peepholes into rooms and stuff. That's what everybody said, right?
Right.
But really, if he's such a swindler, why do you think he was hiring and firing these people so quickly? Go build that, you know, build this hallway. Oh, you didn't do that right. You're fired.
I don't like what you did. Right.
And I don't like what you did, so I don't have to pay you.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's a little more realistic with learning the swindler that he really was.
Right.
So The castle had two stories. The bottom housed a pharmacy, a barbershop, a candy store, a jewelry store, and other shops and a little restaurant. The second story was apartments. It was not a hotel. Sorry.
Oh.
It was for long-term residents. I hate ruining these stories for you guys. I'm sorry, but it was an apartment complex.
Debunk.
It was not a hotel. Later, that comes into play when he builds the third floor, but we'll get there. He was such a scam artist. I think that is his number one crime. I mean, yes, we'll talk about other things later, but he was such a scam artist. He purchased this huge soundproof safe. Why soundproof? That is a little sketch to me. That he built into the room across from his office on the second floor.
A soundproof safe?
Yeah. And he bought this on credit. And he used it as a safe. And stories have that that's where he would gas victims or keep victims or women and what have you. Fact is, it was a soundproof safe. It was this huge safe. But he used it as a safe too. And he had it installed and he put it all on credit. Well, the investors come because they're like, dude, this safe is like a big deal. I need the money for it. He's like, okay, go ahead, but don't damage my building, because it had already been like installed in the walls.
Right.
So they assess it and they're like, we can't do it. We can't touch this. So that was that.
Oh my gosh.
There was a company that tried to sue him, and he's like, guys, you can sue me all you want, but this building and the land is all in my mother-in-law's name. So, and they're like, well, we have never talked to her. We've been talking to you this entire time. Mm-hmm. And he's like, well, the beam you installed was not big enough. I wasn't happy with what you did, so I'm not paying you. I mean, he was just, and he was getting away with all of this.
Shyster.
Yeah.
Shyster.
I don't want to ruin the whole tale you've been told of H.H. Holmes, but up to this point, he's just a scam artist, con artist. He's a swindler. He's not a killer. That being said, I can't say he wasn't a weirdo. Employees of his building did grow used to his oddness. Employees were told to go into the safe and scream and yell so that he could make sure it was soundproof. And they were like used to this.
I'm still questioning, why is a soundproof safe even made? Why is that even a thing?
I don't know.
Okay.
I don't know. The housekeeper would catch him tiptoeing around like at really odd hours in the middle of the night. 2 a.m. He's like tiptoeing down the hallway. That's weird.
Ew.
The janitor who worked the pharmacy recalled a time when Holmes showed him fake beards and disguises he had. He's kind of a weirdo.
Kinda. He is a weirdo.
Go get in the safe and scream.
Yes, sir.
Get your paycheck when you get out. Now, then there is the story of Charles Chapel. And again, I don't know how factual this story is, but he was a real person. And this is his account, Charles Chapel's account. He was a laborer on some part of the building when it was being built. And somehow or another, he and Holmes started apparently discussing medical school and how Chapel had used to work in the anatomy lab at a medical school. And this thrilled Holmes to hear somebody else who like enjoyed anatomy and human bodies like he did. So he takes Chapel to see a partially dissected corpse up in his room.
This is Holmes?
Yeah.
Okay.
And he says, I will pay you $36 if you finish the dissection of this so that we can sell the skeleton to a medical school. And Chapel was like, sure. So he got paid money, and then
he actually got paid.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, right. And well, because I guess he's got to keep quiet too.
Mm-hmm.
So he gets paid. That was a really good point, Mom. And
thank you.
Holmes turns around and sells the skeleton for like $200 to a medical school or a doctor or something.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. That's like a story. Again, So when did the killings begin? Well, In 1890, he sold that first pharmacy he bought, and he left the new owner in a really bad situation because as soon as the new owner took ownership, the creditors swooped in and basically cleared all the shelves because they were never paid. They trusted Holmes, but not this new guy, right? I mean, come on. Holmes, he still spent a lot of time over there. He probably just such a charmer. He spent a lot of time hanging out at the old pharmacy. One day, one of his original investors showed up and really seemed pretty upset about something.
Yeah.
And he left in a rage. And as he's leaving, he collapsed outside of the building. Dr. Holmes rushes to his aid. He pours a dark liquid into the man's mouth. And within minutes, the man was dead. Was this his
true
first kill? Is this true?
Is this true or false?
Is this his first kill? Another case was a year prior. This was in 1889. Now, this one is more on the true side. It's sad.
Okay. Oh.
The new building's complete and a new family, a young family moves in, the Connors, Ned, Julia, and their daughter, Pearl. Ned and Julia worked in the jewelry store downstairs.
Okay.
And they lived in one of the apartments in the building. Julia and Holmes begin an affair right away, even though Murda is like living right down the hallway.
And Julia's husband is living on the other side of the hallway. Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. This goes on for like 2 years before Ned's like, I'm out of here. This is baloney. It took 2 years for him to find out. So he leaves and soon the two are engaged. Huh? Murda is like living up north now, still in Chicago, in like an apartment somewhere else. I'm sure he conned her into out of the building. I don't know, but he's still married to these two women, but now he's engaged to Julia. He also started to take out debts in Julia's name.
Oh, for goodness sake.
Now we don't know the specifics, but it's believed that Julia got pregnant around November of 1891. From stories, Holmes told Julia that he did not want a baby, and he was also struggling with Julia's 8-year-old daughter, Pearl, at this time, and he was not ready for a family, didn't want a family. So he told her, I'll marry you if you have an abortion, and he would perform the abortion.
Oh, no. Ugh.
Christmas Eve is when, for some reason, Christmas Eve, but that's when it's assumed it happened, because after Christmas of 1991, neither Julia nor Pearl were ever seen again. It is assumed that, and Holmes later hinted kinda, that Julia died during the abortion. Is that because he failed the abortion because he didn't know what he was doing? And so right. She died, or did he do it on purpose? We don't know. And then Pearl's missing. So even if the abortion went wrong, he still had to
Where
go
is
and
she?
Kill Pearl.
Right.
He was a big chloroform guy. So they're assuming that's how he killed the little girl. And that skeleton that Chapel had worked on for Holmes is said to belong to Julia Connors.
Oh.
That is hanging in a doctor's office somewhere. Ooh. Yeah. Now, there was skeletons found in the investigation with the media that I told in the very beginning. We'll get
yes.
there.
Okay.
So Holmes began a new business venture around this time, too. He purchased a glass bending company. He convinced everyone he had created some new technique to glass bending. There was a big party and this big show to showcase his new furnace. But it's been said that no one ever saw him bending glass or burning anything. It's also said that after purchasing the said furnace, women in his life started to disappear a little more frequently. Like his fiance, Emmeline Sagrand, a young, beautiful typewriter girl.
Oh, another one. Okay. Okay.
Yep. A young, beautiful typewriter girl he hired in 1892 who disappeared the Christmas after Julia disappeared. Holmes told everyone that she'd gone on to Europe to get married after being engaged to
him. Okay.
I will say some suspect the furnace and others suspect another failed abortion with Emmeline's disappearance. Mm. But then where's her body?
Right.
Again, besides the fact that these women were never seen again, we don't know what happened to them. We don't know the facts. Minnie Williams came into his life at the perfect time. The time of Chicago hosting the World's Fair.
That's right. Yeah.
Do you know about the World's Fair?
Mm-hmm.
I knew kind of about it, but I had a lot of fun looking
it
into
was
this.
super cool.
It was the 400th anniversary of Christopher Columbus's arrival to the New World. It went from May to October, so it's this big 6-month affair. Like 27 million tickets were sold.
Wow.
Like, it's crazy. Once it was announced that America was going to host the fair, they put a vote of what city was going to host it. New York, St. Louis, Chicago won. And the city like set to work. That was another reason why there's this scramble of growth for people and businesses and skyscrapers and everything else. That's how they got the name the White City, is because the skyscrapers they're building had that white facade to them. Just such this rush to make this beautiful for the World's Fair. But the, like I said, the police growth is not really keeping up with this. Mm-hmm. That being said, there is a lot of people that went missing from the World's Fair. A lot of people took advantage of
all the chaos.
These people. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Let's see, 46 nations participated in the fair. There were exhibits of artists, musicians, carnival rides showcasing the original Ferris wheel. And fun fact, the guy who made the first amusement park, the Steeplechase Park in Coney Island, he got his idea for that at the World's Fair.
Hmm.
The fair also showcased the first moving walkway, or the Travelator. I mean, think about this. They're going from nothing to all of a sudden the Travelator and a Ferris wheel, and they have their first moving pictures. And I mean, it literally went from like nothing to like, boom, all of this stuff. Isn't that crazy to you?
I know it is. It was a cool, super cool thing.
Yeah, it was the biggest event in America. It was an introduction to the new age. Yep, 27 million paid admission. People came from all over America, the world, but people saved up for this event. This is the Midwest. A lot of people are coming from small towns and they've never seen a building more than like 3 stories high. So this is like so cool to them. Other things introduced at the fair were Juicy Fruit gum, cream of wheat, Cracker Jacks, shredded wheat cereal, and Pabst Blue Ribbon beer, which still showcases the blue ribbon that they won at the fair on their cans today.
Oh, that's cool. I didn't know that.
So the biggest event is coming to Chicago, and H.H. Holmes wants in on this. He wants to expand his building to 3 stories, opening up the third floor for fairgoers, and rent it out like a hotel, naming it the World's Fair Hotel. Now, building this third floor on credit was really easy for Holmes at this point because everybody wants in on money right now. So all of the furniture and hardwood floors and any construction crews, they're in on World's Fair money too. Like, they want to get their name out there and furnish a new hotel and put their name out there. So they're going to get stuff out there quickly too.
Wow.
So he's putting things on credit really easily with this third floor. And like I said, many people did go missing. This was the beginning also of female independence. Women were taking the train now to the city. They're also allowed now to be paid. I mean, we still don't have all of our rights. We're not getting paid equally at this time, but we're able to get paid and get our own jobs. And they were coming to Chicago a lot at this time for that possibility. And there were a lot of people that took advantage of these women that are independently coming out. Legend has it that Holmes was the guy who took advantage of this. In actuality, and I hate to ruin this for you guys, there's no record of anyone ever staying at his hotel during the World's Fair.
Ever?
Not a single person. Because in August, so 3 months after the fair started, the third floor of the building mysteriously caught fire. Sorry, you guys. I'm sorry. That's like the story, is that he got all these women to his murder castle and killed them at the World's Fair.
Nada.
There's no record that he checked anybody into his hotel. He filed a huge insurance claim on this loft, but the company was not fooled, and H.H. Holmes was forced to skip town. They're starting to catch up to him and his scams.
Oh.
So I need to back up because I forgot the important character in this story, Minnie Williams. I mentioned her before as the woman who came into his life at the most perfect time of the World's Fair. Minnie was from Texas. Now, I mean this with full respect, but most of Holmes's love interests, and I hate to use the word love interest because I don't think he was capable of love. Personally, I think all of these women in his life, there was a reason for them.
He used them.
Yeah. And he's keeping this facade and this charm of this prosperous businessman. Who's going to take him seriously if he's not married, right? Like, and he's so charming. And so everybody keeps saying that he was like this love guy and he'd fall in love or he loved this person. I think there was always a reason to it. I don't think that there was. I don't think he was really capable of love. My opinion. That's honestly just my opinion. Okay. But the women that were in his life were usually very pretty, very beautiful women. And several quotes I read about Minnie, quote, she didn't know a lot, unquote. She was a larger woman. Okay. She was a Texas heiress. She had a lot of money. And the only thing standing in his way of this money was Minnie's sister, Nanny. The two girls lived in an apartment on the north side of Chicago, and Holmes set to work to woo them both. He would take them to the fair at night, treat them, charm them. And then in July of 1893, the two sisters disappeared.
Both of them?
Mm-hmm. Holmes would go on to say that Minnie killed Nanny because she was getting jealous of the time he was spending with Nanny. This is Holmes. So a lot of the other deaths were women that went missing. It was she went off to Europe to get married or she left to go be with family.
But he admits that.
But this one with Minnie, he says that Minnie did it. Minnie killed Nanny and she disappeared. She's a con artist. She's done most of the things you guys are blaming me for. She's a horrible human being.
Oh.
She's committed all of these crimes. He blamed her for everything. He said she killed her sister and then just disappeared. So Minnie and Nanny disappear in July. The building's third floor burns down in August. And after that, Holmes and his new lover, Georgiana Yoke, leave Chicago. They get married. Oh. What was this? Three wives?
Yep.
Who's counting? They get married and they head to Denver first to collect money due to Minnie from her brother's death in a mining accident.
How are they getting this, though?
Minnie's brother dies and he goes and gets the money. They then head to Texas to steal land that Minnie had owned. Holmes's plan to build another castle, this time twice as big. But of course, again, all on credit. Another character that plays an important role in Holmes's new story is Benjamin Peitzel. All bad guys need a sidekick, right? Well, that was Peitzel. Peitzel had worked deals and swindled with Holmes back in Chicago. He was a bit of a drunk, but he was loyal to Holmes, and the two swindled together a lot. Peitzel came out to Texas for a while, and the two began their swindling to creditors for the new building. Holmes never would stick around to see this building. This never came to fruition.
Oh.
The two took out tens of thousands of dollars of mortgages on the land and, of course, never made any payments on them. And this is in Fort Worth, Texas. I don't know if I mentioned that or not. But they also tried their hand at horse swindling. They were stealing horses. Peitzel got arrested for bad checks. And while he was in prison serving this time, Holmes paid some pretty hefty premiums on Peitzel's life insurance. Two had a plan, a big plan, and it was going to take some time, but they were going to fake Peitzel's death and then split the life insurance money that came in. Side note, Peitzel is married and he has like 7 kids.
Oh, creep.
Yeah. And it also says that he was a very loving father. I mean, he was like involved in his kids' life, all 7 of them. Anyway.
Okay.
But this plan is going to take some time. The two just kept on swindling to take up that time because they had to build up that premium, right? They moved to St. Louis. They bought a drugstore for $50 and promises. Peitzel didn't. Holmes did. Peitzel then goes to the drugstore supplier and convinced them that he was interested in buying the drugstore from Holmes. If they lent him the money, he would use them as his main supplier. They agree. Obviously, the men are caught and Holmes is actually arrested for pharmacy fraud. So the first time that Holmes is arrested, and I think he was in jail for like 3 days.
Oh, geez.
But while in jail, he did a lot of talking, ragging. Oh, this is nothing. Life insurance fraud is the way to go. More money in that for sure. He then meets the handsome bandit. Yes, that is his name. You can even find him on Wikipedia. He's a thing. His name is Marion Hedgepeth. He was a really pretty famous outlaw in like the Midwest at the time. And Holmes is like bragging to the handsome bandit about life insurance and money he's making. He's really trying to impress this handsome bandit.
Right, yeah.
Peitzel and Holmes both get out of jail and the two head to Philadelphia. A suggestion made by the handsome bandit. I think Holmes promised him, like, I'll pay you if you tell me about some kind of lawyer that's going to help us with this life insurance fraud that we're trying to run. So the handsome bandit helps him. The handsome bandit, of course, turns Holmes in later on. He is part of turning Holmes in and making this story, like, this is what happened, kind of, so that he doesn't stay in prison for much longer. So that handsome bandit. Okay, so they go to Philadelphia. They set up this fake business for Benjamin Peitzel. He was going to pose as an owner of a company selling and buying patents. And he would be posing as an inventor as well. And they do a really good job because he actually gets customers that are trying to sell him their patents.
Mm-hmm.
One client came to the building for a meeting and discovered the body of Benjamin Peitzel. He looked to have died in a lab explosion of some kind. The life insurance money went to Peitzel's widow, rightfully so.
Mm-hmm.
But good old Holmes swoops in and collects most of the money. I think she got like $10,000, and he comes and he says, you owe me $7,500 for the building that we're building in Texas.
Oh.
Yes. Okay, so this is where the story gets really confusing and really odd. But apparently, after he takes all that money, he decides he wants to do a good deed for her. And he says, well, I will take three of your children off your hands and travel with them to Indianapolis to stay with their aunt. So he and his wife, Georgiana, right? That's his wife right now.
Yeah, number three. Mm-hmm.
They take these three children and they start their trek. And I guess she really trusted him with her three children. That this part of the story just gets so weird to me. He, his wife, and these three kids. And some suggest that Holmes knew at this time that his gig was up. He was a wanted man. So who's going to be looking for a man traveling with his wife and three kids?
Mm-hmm.
They're just going to be looking for him. That's what people assume. And I think that kind of makes sense too.
It does. Yeah. Because he uses everybody. Sure.
Regardless, he's moving these children all over the country with him. All along this time, he tells the mother of these children, the death of your husband was a scam. He's alive and he's in Canada. So I'm actually just going to take your kids to Canada so that they can be with their father. Holmes was eventually tracked down in Boston, where he was arrested for horse theft from his swindling out in Texas.
Texas, okay.
And when he's being brought in, he's like really, really, really scared, like super nervous. And then he sees this insurance agent at the station and he instantly relaxes because horse thievery in Texas is like a hanging offense. It's like a horrible thing to do and you could hang for it. So he's like terrified being brought in. And then he sees this insurance agent. He's like, he literally says like, oh yes, I'm an insurance swindler. I did it. I frauded the insurance companies. Take me now. Like that's what I did. Because he thought he was like going down for the horses. Okay. So he's on trial. Am I bouncing around too much?
Mm-mm.
Okay, he's on trial for this insurance scam with Peitzel. And his story becomes, well, Benjamin Peitzel committed suicide.
Oh.
And I wanted his family to get the insurance money like they deserved. So I staged the area to look like an accident. And the staging, I guess, was horrible. The Peitzel's face was messed up, but like nothing else was messed up. So it was supposed to be like a lab explosion. So I don't think he thought Peitzel was going to be found as soon as he did. I think he thought maybe he'd decompose a little.
Right.
Mm-hmm. He'd have some time. Okay. So he says, I staged the area to look like an accident. So the family got the money. Okay. Well, then his attorney takes him back and is like, okay, man, that's a good story and all. But if that's the case, then where are the children? Where are they? You were picked up in Boston. Where are these kids? Oh, well, the children, they're fine. I sent them to go stay with my sweet, dear old friend, Minnie Williams in London.
Minnie's dead. Well, how about his wife, Georgia, or whatever her name is?
I don't know. In all of the stories I read, research, historians, legend, all of it, she just kind of like dipped.
Disappears. Like she never existed.
These kids are driving me crazy. Why are we traveling with three children? I'm dipping. I'm done. Okay. So there's this Philadelphia detective working the case. While this trial is going on for Benjamin Peitzel insurance money, whatever, the story about these children is just off to him. So he goes in search of like what is going on? So he goes on the trail, because at the beginning of this, it was like an adventure to these kids. And they went to so many different places, and they'd rent out houses and rent out apartments, and they'd stay different places. So he starts at the beginning, and this detective is just going to all these places. Well, he discovers a house that there's a smell coming from the basement. They do end up finding two little girls and a boy. They found two little girls buried in a shallow grave in this house that Holmes had rented in the basement.
Oh no.
It's believed that they were put in a trunk and he gassed them in the trunk. That's part legend, I think, to make it more traumatic, but it's killing children. So I think it's incredibly traumatic no matter how he did it. I think chloroform was his
go-to.
So I kind of leaned more towards that. But then the little boy, his body was never really discovered, but bones were discovered in the fireplace. And I think you covered that house as a haunting.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I did. Yeah.
Yeah. It is discovered that the children are all dead. Once the children's bodies were discovered, several other authorities decided to have a closer look at this Holmes fella, and they decided to head to his castle in Chicago. Now, like I began this episode, the chief of police had no experience of in any of this, right? So this is the most ineffective investigation. There were bones discovered in the basement. But like I said, the media was all up in there too. So if a bone was found, they're like passing these bones around.
Oh, jeez.
And as I mentioned, this is the yellow journalism era. So a bench in the basement became a table used to dismember bodies. A barrel discovered had potentially had acid in it to dissolve bodies. Mm-hmm. A rope they found had hung several women who had gone missing from the World's Fair. The stories were astounding. The New York World prints an article with this diagram. And in the diagram, it's a diagram of the murder castle.
Mm-hmm.
And it names rooms. The secret hanging chamber, the asphyxiation chamber, the maze, and they name it the murder castle.
Uh-huh.
Or the murder factory.
Oh, jeez.
They wrote up this whole huge article blaming Holmes for the hundreds of people that did not return home from their visit to the World's Fair, filling their articles with stories that had printed in Chicago, and then just filling in the holes and the gaps with imagination and
mm-hmm.
The mundane parts, they want to like add the flair. Other papers around the United States reprint this article.
Mm.
So now we have this sensationalized story of H.H. Holmes. Holmes would go on trial now for the death of Benjamin Peitzel, and he would be convicted to death by hanging. As he waited his execution, the media is still going crazy over this Holmes case, and many of them are negotiating with him to give his last confession, his last interview.
Okay.
The New York World that printed that
mm-hmm.
huge story, they're turned down and they're really sour about it. They go back and they print another article. And this time they say, quote, Holmes is about to write a confession where he killed 20 people, unquote. So now whoever Holmes chooses to give his statement to,
uh-huh.
he can't look bad. He can't say anything less than
that.
20. Yeah. He can't just say nothing now either. I mean, because this is H.H. Holmes. He's become such an American legend and he knows it. So he knows he has to give a great interview and he's eating all this up and he truly plays this role. He gives an interview confessing that he killed 27 people. But like I mentioned before, like 10 of those people are walking around still out there. Like,
so he named them too.
Yeah.
Gosh.
Holmes was executed. He was hung on your birthday. Aww.
Yep.
May 7th, 1896. He was brought in. Okay, so he requested to be buried in a block of cement because he didn't want people messing with his body after he was buried. But it's like, because
like he used to do that. So
yeah.
Who would even think about that except somebody who used to mess with bodies, right?
Well, I guess he got offers from some people saying like, can we hang your skeleton at a carnival? You're H.H. Holmes. We want to hang your body somewhere.
Oh.
Yeah. But so he's like, no, I want to be buried in cement so nobody can mess with me. He's just rude. So that's the story of H.H. Holmes. Maybe there's still a lot of unknown in his story. But it really made me think about all the stories we've shared and how has this happened in other stories? Maybe not this dramatic of a whole murder castle, but has a newspaper maybe printed something to get somebody's attention just a little bit? And then that just grows and grows, like a game of telephone that just
mm-hmm.
to get people's attention. Like, do you think this happens in other stories? I think it happens in other stories.
Well, we know we do.
Watching it
it's
happen
happening
in other stories.
in the Iowa murder case with the students.
Idaho, yeah.
Idaho, I'm sorry. Idaho murder case
Idaho,
with the students.
Iowa, yeah.
Totally different states. But it's happening there.
I know.
I mean,
it's happening everywhere. And it
and that's like why we try to not use newspaper and media as our total resources.
I think it's almost going back to the yellow journalism era with how people are doing clickbait and
well, that's what it is.
It's horrible.
That's exactly what it is.
So,
and they just renamed yellow journalism to clickbait.
Yeah, that's true. It makes me hope. I hope then that any of the stories we share, though, are, I guess we're doing the best we can by the resources we're looking at. But do we really know? Like, that's
right. Especially the older ones, the older cases.
Yeah. My coffee's cold now, but I really want to drink it. I was really excited to cover him, though. And like I said, I thought it was going to be straightforward. It was going to be this gruesome tale. I was so excited to share it. The murder castle. And there is, okay, so again, facts. The building was torn down, his murder castle. The castle was torn down. And there's a post office, but the post office is only on like, so remember he bought lot 701, 702, and 703. Mm-hmm, the post office is on like the tip of like 703 or something like that. So there's a post office there now, but it's not even on the land of the murder castle.
Okay.
So it's like right next door.
Hasn't the murder castle been torn down?
Yeah, that's what I just said.
Oh, I'm sorry. Yeah.
It's okay. It's okay. You're not listening. That's fine. Yes, it's been torn down. And they have, I don't believe they have anything built there. But the post office is like on the edge of it. But the post office claims that we're on the site of the murder castle. And there's like paranormal shows that they've done stuff there. And like that Adam Seltzer historian guy, that podcast is great. I'll put a link to it. He does this huge interview on all the research he's done and what he's found on H.H. Holmes, like the facts. And it's put out by the History Channel. But I went on the History Channel after I listened to that podcast and that interview. And there's like a whole H.H. Holmes episode on the History Channel. And I was like, oh, cool. Like that was so factual. Let's see what this has. That whole thing on the same channel was all the sensationalized story. There was nothing about.
Right.
And it's like, I work in the post office and there's things happening in the basement. And it's like, but the basement isn't even the original building. Like it's gone. That's not saying that maybe Pearl, the little 8-year-old, and Julia, maybe their spirits are still there. That's not saying that they're not, but I'm just, it's just, I don't know. All right. I'm rambling. I need to stop. Mom, tell us a paranormal story from Illinois, please.
Yeah, this was I actually asked Beth because, you know, I just don't want to do another hotel and theater. And I just didn't get into that. So she goes, hey, how about doing this idea?
Oh, you used the idea I gave you? I gave you two. One of them was one you already did. So that proves how much I pay attention.
I go, don't you remember? I already did this one.
As I sent it, it sounded familiar, but.
Yeah. Yeah.
Sorry.
But I am going to share two hauntings.
Okay.
Of course. Or urban legends.
Oh, and this is like the urban legend episode.
Yeah, I'm not sure what to call these. Hauntings or urban legends, but let's go forward.
Okay.
The first one is the Devil's Stone. In 1975, Gilbert and Trudy Woods of Glen Ellen, Illinois, dug up a strange terracotta stone or rock. It's not a rock. I consider rocks small. This is a stone in their backyard.
Okay.
Maybe the other way around. Okay. Stone is small. Rock is bigger.
Yeah, I was going to say like a pebble. I think like a pebble and then a stone and then a rock.
Okay. Rock.
The Roswell rock.
This did not fit into anybody's pants.
Summer, dude.
This rock, I never found measurements on any site. Actually, there's not
so
too much.
So it could fit in his pants.
No, because I saw a picture of it sitting next to this parapsychologist who I'll talk about. But it looked like it was up to her knees and then she had her hand on it. So I kind of looked at the width of her hand compared to the width of the stone. And so I'm putting this together in my head and it comes up to approximately 15 inches high and 20 inches across.
Okay, sure.
Okay. Yeah. So just to give you an idea. And it's terracotta.
Yep, got it.
It had what looked like ornamentation around it. So like curvy little things. And in the middle was a shield. It looked like a shield. Okay.
Like etched into it?
Yes.
Okay.
So it isn't just this flat rock. Okay.
Got it.
It's got etching in it. On the shield were four different objects. As you look at it, on the upper right hand was the infinity sign.
Okay.
On the lower left is a snake, just kind of coiled up.
Gross. Okay. Gross. Gross. Yeah.
All right. On the upper left are squares, and okay, some of them are carved deeper than others. So it kind of goes deep, up, deep, up, deep, up, and they're squares.
Okay.
On the lower right, same idea, but they're diamonds. Very, very, very odd. I mean, Gilbert thought this rock was super cool, of course.
Okay.
Yeah, it was. And he put it in his rock garden around a fountain he had made.
Yeah. I mean, if I found some etched rock, I think it would be pretty cool too.
Pretty cool too. Right after the rock was unburied, unearthed, strange things started happening. Trudy claimed she saw lights turning on and off, and the radio station would change. Like, listening
and like, how do you pinpoint that to a rock? Like, right away, right? Things aren't happening. You don't all of a sudden go, well, I put that rock in our garden.
No, I'm pretty sure it's like over time, a little bit of time. It's like, wait, these odd things. At night, she would feel other people, quote, other people in the room.
What?
She would just feel eyes looking at her.
Oh, I don't like
in
that.
In the room.
I don't like that at all.
Their children claimed that they felt something touching their feet at night while they were in bed.
Oh, that's like that one haunting. I don't remember where it was, where their feet were getting tickled at night. That's horrible. I think that's probably like one of the worst hauntings we've ever heard about, is the tickling and touching of your feet. Can you imagine?
I mean, kids didn't say they were tickled, but can you imagine something touching your feet? I mean, that's like the boogeyman all over again.
That's like that story we were told when we were in like middle school, where they're like, yeah, you reach down and you pet your dog and your dog licked you or whatever, but dogs aren't the only things that lick. Sorry.
The guy in the interview, Gilbert, he says, yeah, you know, quote, just the nickel and dime stuff.
What does that even mean?
Oh, you know, your average haunting.
Yeah.
That's what he said.
Okay.
Nickel and dime stuff.
I like it.
Until Gilbert had a heart attack.
Oh, well, that's not a nickel and dime.
He didn't die, but he had
a dollar.
He had a heart attack, and Trudy unexplainably lost her eyesight for 3 months.
Oh, my gosh.
And was diagnosed with multiple sclerosis.
Okay, we're talking like not nickel and dime, like $10 now.
We're up in the price here.
Yeah.
And it all this stuff started adding up, and they're like, let's get rid of the rock.
But again, how do you narrow it down to a rock? All these things are happening. How do you sit back and go,
it's the rock?
It has to be the rock. How do people, and I think this about other stories, not just this one, where things are happening and it's like, oh, it must be the table we bought. Like, if things aren't happening around my house right now, I don't know what I would even consider blaming it on.
Well, not
the sweater I got on Amazon. Like,
not
I don't
many
know.
People get Amazon, you know, 5 Amazon packages a day either. I mean, personally, I would know if something weird started
Amazon
happening.
I will never talk poorly about. This is not an ad, but as a mom of 3 kids who can't get out in the house, it's snow day. Hello. And I had Valentine's parties and birthday parties and crap to plan. Thank God for Amazon. Don't you hate on my Amazon? But I just don't know how I would blame one particular thing for these horrible things happening.
Well, you know, maybe that was the only thing that came new into their lives.
It's besides the point. They're smarter than me and they figured it out.
Yeah.
Okay.
Okay. So they're getting rid of this because it's bad juju, right?
Yeah.
So what do they do? They give it to their friend.
Oh, no.
Linda Kleist in 1979.
Oh, poor Linda.
I'm not sure if she asked for it. Okay, maybe she asked for it. Maybe she said, oh, I'll take that rock from you. Or maybe they said, hey, look, this cool rock, Linda. You're not really a great friend. Let me give you this rock.
Yeah. Oh, no.
I don't know how
that
happened.
Poor Linda. What happened to Linda?
After receiving the rock, all kinds of things went wrong in Linda's life. Horrible migraines that she didn't have before. She got hepatitis 3 times, and she was in a 5-car crash.
Oh my gosh. So now you're officially being like, okay, it has to be the rock.
Get this. In the winter, her house would be infested with bees.
What?
Then that kind of reminds me of Amityville Horror with the flies.
The flies.
Mm-hmm.
Do you remember my old house? There was that one room, the one, oh, the guest room where you stayed, that was always had flies in the window. I was constantly cleaning out tons and tons of flies from windowsill.
In the bathroom. Yeah.
I hated that. I always got bad feelings in that room.
Oh, I'd rather stay in that room than downstairs.
There was something in that house.
There
I
was
don't
something
know,
in that house.
I don't
house.
Know why, but there was. And I keep making this all about me. Go on.
Okay. Her good friend, Maria Miller, as she had this rock, her good friend, Maria Miller, was diagnosed with cancer after she took a picture of the rock. So her good friend took a picture of the rock. Then she was diagnosed with cancer. Okay. Circumstance. And then 2 years to the day that Linda got the rock from Gilbert, Miller
died. She kept
died.
It for 2 years. So after that, she still kept it?
Well, maybe it, I don't
now,
know.
This is making sense if it's one family and now another.
So,
okay, so 2 years after
two
she was
years
rock, who dies?
To the date that she got that rock, Miller, her good friend with cancer, died to the
Okay.
date. So it's weird. Linda got rid of the rock and says she has had no problems since.
Who would she give the rock to?
Just as Trudy and Gilbert have also stated
what
that.
What did she do with the rock? Is it just out there for more people to find?
No. The rock next went to Evelyn Paglini, a parapsychologist. She
oh,
wanted
okay.
it.
Okay.
She wanted it.
Okay. I was like, another friend? They're just like, here you go, your turn. It's like the traveling pants, but totally bass backwards.
Yeah. Okay. So I think she asked for it, but she also had strange things happen in her life, but she never kind of really disclosed that to anybody. I could never see what. She did figure out that the infinity sign and the snake on the rock were symbols of the struggle between good and evil. The meaning of the raised diamonds and squares remains a mystery, even to this day. Her assistant, Linda Herakic, one night saw 2 red floating eyes near the stone, the rock, sorry. Looking closer, she saw what looked like a baby with red eyes leaning against the stone. I'm sorry.
Scary.
I'm just thinking of this baby going, so what are you doing?
That's what I picture. Do you remember that video that was going crazy years ago, like the dancing baby in the diaper? It was all over the internet. Like, that's the kind of baby I'm picturing, just like
she was filled with uncontrollable rage, which dissipated when she left the room. A professional photographer took pictures of the rock. And
why
I guess
if nobody learned their stinking lesson yet about this rock.
I don't, you know, it's
the
sort of
person
like
who
that.
Took a picture last time got cancer and
yeah
died.
Well, the person that took pictures of it this time, 2 days later at midnight, her house burnt to the ground for no unknown reason.
For no unknown reason.
For no unknown reason. Cross that,
that house
no
just...
Hey, edit that no out there. She was not injured. It is unclear as to where the rock is now.
Thank God she wasn't injured.
Well, she just took a dang picture of it. No one
gosh,
knows where
it.
The rock is right now. So just saying, watch out for this terracotta rock. It's floating around somewhere.
Wait, I missed it because I was still thinking of no unknown. The rock's just out there?
Mm-hmm.
But how do you get rid of that kind of a thing? Because like a Ouija board, you're not supposed to burn it or anything like that. You're
how
supposed
do you
to
burn a rock anyway?
Well, I mean, like crash it, like crush it. Crash it over somebody's head. No, crush it. Like, you know, stomp on it. Break it. Throw it. Throw it in a river. Like the Jumanji board.
I don't know. But if you bury it or throw it in a river, it might just reemerge later. Somebody might go scuba
so
diving and go, oh, this is cool.
So you etch into it, leave me alone. Leave me here. Do not touch.
Do not touch.
People really follow directions nowadays.
That would be all the more reason for them to grab it.
Oh, I totally need this in my garden. Leave me alone. Perfect. Put it right by the front door.
Okay, I'm moving on to my second story.
Oh, you have a second story. Okay.
Yes. Okay, think. The 1969 classic Rosemary's Baby.
Got
Have
it.
you ever seen it?
Yes, I had to watch it in film class.
Okay. My mother made me watch it. She loved it.
She would.
She would. Sorry, Mom. The Jane Addams Hull House, that's Hull, H-U-L-L, mm-hmm. House Museum at the University of Illinois at Chicago is the oldest building in the center part of the city. The Victorian Mansion, so it's a mansion, okay? It's a Victorian mansion, and it dates back way back. So I'm going to go to the history of this place.
Got it.
All right. The Victorian Mansion was built in 1856 for Charles J. Hull and his family. He only lived in the mansion for 4 years, during which time his wife and two sons died. And he is like, not staying here anymore. I don't care if there's a rock or not. I'm grabbing my daughter and we're hightailing it to another mansion across town. That's what they did. In 1889, the Hull Mansion was purchased by Jane Addams and Ellen Gates. They converted the mansion into Chicago's first settlement house. Now, I didn't know what a settlement house was. Do you?
No. I was hoping you were going to explain that to me.
Well, I'm just going to act like I know what that is. The purpose of a settlement house is to bring the poor and the rich of a city together in a social way. That'll make more sense when you hear what they converted this mansion to. They started converting the mansion, expanding it to a 13-building complex, taking up close to a whole city block. The structure had a gym, theater, art gallery, music school, auditorium, cafeteria, post office, libraries, just to name a few. So that it brings people from all sections of life together
that's
to join
kinda cool.
in this community, kind of community center.
Yeah, that's what I was just going to ask. Is it a community, like a community center?
That's what it's, yeah. Every day, thousands of people would visit and use the facility. It became known as the best settlement house in the U.S. Going back to the Hull House, the Hull Mansion. Long before Adams moved into the mansion, it was thought to be haunted. Adams, who did not believe in ghosts, admits in several of her books that she named a room, quote, the haunted bedroom. She slept in that room for only a short time, reason being that often she would be awakened in the middle of the night, and as she opened her eyes, there was a woman hovering over her.
Oh, no. No, thank you.
She would also hear conversations from disembodied voices, but only in that bedroom. She moved to another room. This reminds me of The Rock moving to a friend, because what she did is converted that bedroom into the guest room.
Come stay at my house. I'd love for you to visit me in Chicago, but beware of the woman that's going to dangle on top of you while you sleep.
It's like, I don't know whether... I don't have another room for my guests, so I'm going to make this a guest room. And
isn't it a mansion? Isn't there tons of freaking rooms?
Or maybe it was an experiment.
You keep saying the goal mansion, right?
The
goal.
Hull.
Close enough.
Goal. I don't know where that mansion is. The whole mansion. It is a mansion. So
there's
got to
be other rooms, right?
Or maybe she was just using it as an experiment.
That's
Let's see.
A mean experiment. You're right. It is like, here, take this rock. I'd love for you to see what happens.
Or maybe she just had a really dark sense of humor.
That's sick.
But her guests did complain
about a woman hanging over them
in the middle of the night and a woman hovering over them.
I'm thinking this
woman just kind of...
I know. That's not even like a small haunting.
Them.
Like, that's like...
A full apparition.
That's like a scary movie kind of haunting.
Over your head. Yeah.
So did she give them a new room?
Well, she made that room then a storage area.
Good. That's what it probably should have become.
Now the woman's
right away.
Just hovering over boxes, I guess. I don't know. Now, I did in one resource say that people that lived there before in the mansion had put buckets of water every night in front of that door.
What did that
so
do?
That the spirits couldn't step over it. I guess spirits
dangling
can't,
already can't from the ceiling.
Spirits can't walk on water.
She's already dangling from the ceiling, so
she's not dangling. Don't make it sound like she's She's
like a puppet
dangling. She's like flying over. Think of Superman.
She obviously doesn't need to walk to get anywhere.
Okay.
Did the buckets work?
I don't know. Okay, now back to Rosemary's Baby, because, you know, I told you think of that, and this has nothing to do with it. The story goes that in 1913, a severely deformed baby was left on the doorstep of the mansion. Adams took the helpless baby in, and then mass hysteria broke out, not only in the building, but in surrounding neighborhoods, because everybody heard about this deformed baby. People would come at all hours wanting to pay her to see this baby.
Oh my God, that's making me so sad.
They were calling it the devil baby because it was so deformed.
Oh my gosh, that's horrible.
Yeah. It came to the point where she was turning down bus loads of people.
People are sick. They need a life.
She never let anyone see the baby, who only lived for like 3 or 4 months.
Oh my goodness.
So you might ask, where did this child come from?
Is that the woman dangling over the ceiling? Is she looking for her baby?
No, that woman's long dead. One story.
Yeah, because she's a ghost.
Well, her baby died after her.
Oh, so the woman who woke up with the... Okay. The woman who woke up with the woman on top of her who gave this room to her guests.
Adam.
She received the baby.
Correct, though.
I gotcha.
Okay.
I'm following.
One story is that of a very devout Catholic woman who was married to an atheist. One day when he was at work, she hung a big poster of the Virgin Mary on their wall.
As
the
one
husband,
does.
As one does when one is a devout Catholic. Sorry, I am a devout Catholic. I have no big poster of the Virgin, so I'm just saying. Husband came home from work and tore the poster, ripped it into several shreds, and said, "Oh, I'd rather have the devil's baby than have that picture on the wall."
If you're an atheist, you don't believe in God, do you believe in the devil?
I don't know, but 9 months later. Dun, dun, dun,
dun. I don't like that story. Next.
Some say the baby had red scaly skin, hoof feet, and horns. Others claim that the baby came out with a full head of hair, smoking a cigar, and cussing in 3 languages. I don't know. I don't know what to believe.
The visuals from this episode are not
That's
the unknown.
My drink. The devil and disguise.
Yes. Oh boy. Is there more?
No.
Oh, great. So we really don't know where this baby came from.
No, or if there even was a baby.
Well, she's turning away busloads of people. I'm sure there really was a baby. That's quite
a story. Or is that sensationalized?
Man,
news?
You Chicagoans, Chicagoans, Chicagans, what is, you in Chicago, you you make up quite the tales.
Oh my. Yeah, I see this little gangster baby coming out.
The cigar. Okay. Yes. Visual over. Wow.
I love these legends. I absolutely love them. I didn't realize how much until we start doing this.
They're pretty good. They are.
All right.
All right. That's episode 132. I hope everybody is having a good winter. The groundhog saw his shadow, so 6 more weeks. All the resources from this episode are going to be on our website. KillerHangoverPodcast.com.
Yeah.
Follow us on social media. If you're watching us on YouTube, do
let
the YouTube things. Subscribe.
And let us know what you think.
Leave a comment. Say hey.
Oh yeah, do the YouTube things. Please subscribe to our channel.
I was trying to go up with something clever and I just can't.
Oh, sorry.
What else do I say at the end of episodes? Join us on Patreon. We come out with episodes to the public every other week, but we come out with episodes to fill in those gap weeks on Patreon. So join us there. It's $5 a month and it buys us our cocktail.
Yeah.
Episode.
And we've got 2 new patrons this
last
month. So
awesome. Welcome.
Congratulations and welcome to our little family.
We still don't have a name for our followers, but
yeah,
okay. We'll come up with it. We'll come
the
up with something.
The ovaries just didn't sound good.
I said hangoveries. I've never called our listeners ovaries.
Our hangoveries. Well, really, might as well just say ovaries.
And with that, we're going to end this episode. Mom will be covering the true crime and I will be covering the paranormal or the legend or whatever. Do you remember what state we're covering next?
California.
California. That's right. Why'd you say it like that? All right. Well, nice chatting with you. Cheers, Mama.
Cheers. I love you, kid.